It's Sunday, July 7th, 2013, and this is the Retro Computing Roundtable, show 54. Black to white, but no matter where I go, there's one thing I like to know. Will I ever find my way back to us? The RCR is the Canadian podcast about computer history, nostalgia, and collecting. By computer history enthusiasts, for computer history enthusiasts. I'm today's host. I'm not Carrington Vanston. I'm David Grealish. He was in Toronto. He is in Toronto, Canada, and they have lost their power, and that's why last minute he's not able to be with us. Who knows? He could join at any moment, maybe. So that was part of the joke being the Canadian podcast, because our special guest co-host today is Sid Bolton, and he's in Brantford, also Ontario, also Canada, like Carrington. So that's where that joke comes from. Oh, yeah, in my introduction, I had David Grealish, and he's in Johns Creek, Georgia, surprisingly not Canada. And then Sid Bolton in Brantford, Ontario, Canada wins. So Canada how you doing, Sid? Welcome to the special Canadian edition. You're it. You represent Canada.
I'm going to have to be all of Canada, and I've got a red and white shirt on, so I guess that's going to make me very Canadian today.
I looked at where Brantford was, but I don't remember now, other than, you know, generally speaking. How far away are you from Toronto?
About 60 miles to the west.
Okay. You and Carrington ever met?
Nope. Not, which is not good.
No, he needs to pay a visit to the museum there.
Yes, absolutely.
And why don't we start off with that? Why don't you tell myself and our audience, good audience, about yourself?
So I am 41 years old, the birthday coming up, 42, so I've been playing around with computers for all of my life. When I was around 10 years old, I started out, saw my first personal computer, which was actually an Apple II. My neighbors had gotten one of these things. I used to use their typewriter because the typewriter that I had was one of those sort of mechanical, awful ones that where the keys would always get stuck, and they had an electric typewriter. So one day they said, "Oh, you got to check out this great new typewriter that we have," and it turns out it was an Apple II, and they had actually ordered one of the very first IBM PCs and received one of the very first IBM PCs that was delivered into Canada. And the machine was about a month away, so the computer dealer decided to lend them an Apple II to get them used to actually using a computer. So they had that for about a month. I played around on that. I played around on the IBM PC. First computer game I ever played was the Adventure that Microsoft had released, which, of course, was a version of Colossal Caves. A lot of fun. Of course, it was only text. And, really got me intrigued with computers. And when I went back to school that fall, I told one of the teachers that I was just fascinated with this computer. So he told me that the school had received one computer, and that was the Commodore PET. And that computer was going to service the entire school. And he was looking for one person in every classroom to take care of the computer in case something went wrong, in case the power cord had fallen out and you had to learn how to load programs. So he'd asked me to come by after school to mess around with the PET. And I just fell in love with the PET. I started learning as fast as I could. I learned how to program. I learned how to do everything. So I had sort of touched three computers in the span of about 3 months, which, as I came to find out later, was kind of unusual because really people did not have computers in their home. I saved up to eventually get a VIC-20, which I bought with my own money, my paper route money. I used to deliver the newspaper, which ironically I write for today. And then I was very fortunate. My aunt and uncle came into some money. They won a lottery, actually. And my dad received some money, and he bought me a Commodore 64 and sent me on a course to build an Apple II. So At like 12 years old, I had three computers. I had the VIC-20, which once I got the Commodore 64, I don't know, I threw the VIC-20 in almost in the garbage. I was like, oh, what do I want this thing for? Mm-hmm. And so then I started working on the Commodore 64 and the Apple II. And of course, the Apple II, I only had monochrome. So the Commodore 64, I had everything. My dad bought me the disk drive. He bought me the 1701 monitor. And, yeah, so basically I just fell in love with computers from that time on. And I've, you know, I started programming, obviously at a hobby level. And then I my first commercial gig, believe it or not, was actually when I was 12. I wrote some stuff for one of those magazines and got paid for it. I worked for a game company when I was 16, which was kind of interesting because as soon as I got my license, I was on the highway to go work for this game company for a little bit. And then I kind of got out of that. I did some other stuff. I continued to program all along. My strategy back then was to write public domain software and put it out there, shareware, and then try to build an audience and then open a commercial company, which I did. And yeah, so I did that for a number of years, and then I continued to work professionally writing Windows software and other stuff, and I went from developing stuff in assembler and BASIC into writing in a real language like C. And then ever since I was 16, so we're talking like 25 years ago, I have wanted to open a computer museum. I remember back then seeing the first round of people throwing out technology. So what happened was somebody was getting rid of an Atari computer, and I was like thinking to myself, like, I was a loyal Commodore person, you know. For those that don't know, I mean, if you think the Mac and PC wars are a heated thing today, you have no idea what transpired back in the 80s. There was the Commodore people, the Atari people, there was the Radio Shack people, there was many more brands, right? So there was a lot more fighting about which computers were better. And so while I was very loyal to Commodore, I secretly kind of wanted an Atari. I wanted to know how the other half lived. I wanted to, you know, as much as I made fun of the Coco, I really kind of wanted one just to see what they were like. I really, truly have had a keen interest in all computers. So when I was finally able to acquire one at a reasonable price, as in free, very reasonable, I started taking people up on their offers and people started giving me computers. And by the time I actually sort of got to the point in my life where I could afford to actually build a museum and start, because, you know, there was no government funding for anything like this available. Basically, at that point, I had about 85 computers that I'd kept in storage and in various places, you know, my mom's basement, storage units. I'm sure any computer geek has been through this phenomenon. And in 2005, finally opened up the Personal Computer Museum here in Canada, which to this day is still the only interactive computer museum. There is another computer museum based out of York University, but their collection is mostly Canadian-based, and they're not interactive. If you want to see the collection, you have to call ahead and ask specifically for what you want, and then they have to go around various rooms in the university to find what you're looking for. And they're looking at things from a much more academic standpoint. What I'm trying to do is get people to come out here and interact with the machines that they played with back in the 80s, essentially. I mean, we do have newer computers, but essentially, if you had a computer in the late 70s or the early 80s or mid-80s, we have it. We have it set up. You can play with it. We have about 50 machines that are interactive. And that's a big key differentiator between us and a traditional museum. You can come and actually play with the stuff. We encourage people to mess around and play with the machines. And we've also become a place where people can get rid of their old computers and feel good about it, because a lot of people that come to us have been hanging on to this stuff. They don't know what to do with it. It's sitting in their basements, but they have such an emotional attachment to it. I can't really think of any other machines in the world that people have had this much attachment to. I guess cars can be that way for people too, but essentially there's such an emotional attachment with computers, and that's really what it's about. It's not really about the machines themselves so much as it is the stories behind it and what people remember doing on the computers, the sense of accomplishment they felt. It's a lot different than today. I mean, it's, you know, anybody can really operate a computer, or, and if you look at how powerful something like an iPad is, and considering how easy it is to use, things weren't like that back then, right? So you actually had to know what you were doing to do something great, and so people felt pride using their computers and getting them to do things, and so we love to hear those stories. We love people to come to us and share with us what they remember from those days, and people just have a great time, you know, going through and playing around on these machines, loading up software that they used to use. of course, there was a lot of piracy back then. I think I heard, I was listening to one of your podcasts, there was kind of a comment about how, oh, this is like, this is what the box looked like. This is a common thing for us, you know, like, you know, piracy, although obviously it's wrong, it was one of those things that back in the day really helped build the computer industry. I think without piracy, we wouldn't have the proliferation of computers out there as much as we do, just because a lot of people bought machines based upon how much software they could get. You know, a lot of people chose to buy, say, a Commodore over an Atari, because if they knew somebody who had a bunch of games that they could get for free, that's what they were going to invest their hardware dollars in. So it's kind of an interesting thing to come back and actually look at some of the original stuff, because of course, you know, we collect software and all this other kind of stuff, and we archive it for you know, forever, hopefully. And yeah, so that's kind of it wasn't really a quick overview, it was a long overview, but that's sort of my history and how I led into starting the museum.
What are the hours?
So we're very limited for hours, unfortunately, right now, because we're completely run by volunteers. So nobody here is making any money. Basically, we've got 40 volunteers. We're open every Monday night, so people can come out and visit us on Monday nights, except for holidays. And then we're open right now one Saturday per month. The next time we're open is July 20th, which is, I guess, what, 2 weekends from now. And then, of course, if you can't make it in those times, then just email me and we'll try to figure something out for you. A lot of times we do, for example, school tours. Obviously, we won't be doing any over the summer, but a lot of times, you know, a school will contact us. And we have a couple of retired educators that are volunteers, and so they usually handle those tours because they're used to dealing with the kids, and they're really good at giving, you know, introductions to how everything works. And so basically one Saturday per month for the full open house. But if you can't make it and you're visiting, or if you got a special case, like I've had people come out, they've had visitors from Australia, you know, visiting them in Canada, they really want to see it, they're only here for a couple of days, I'll open up for something like that. I don't mind. But you know, if possible, obviously we prefer people to come on the days that we're open, partly because we go through the effort of turning all the machines on and making it a real experience for people when they visit.
Okay. I was going to ask you, I guess I can still ask you, I'm sure it's changed and evolved in the last 8 years, but certainly you probably have some machines out there that have been there since day one, right?
Yes.
And Have you had to replace some? I guess I was thinking they're on 20, you know, 5 days a week maybe. And
yeah, they we definitely have had problems with machines over the years. There's been some machines, one in particular that we're going to talk about in one of the news stories. The MSI, we have an MSI 8080, and it's worked since day one, and it continues to function and work. The lights dim a little bit when you turn it on, so you know it's sucking a lot of power, but you know, it's still there working. We've had, because myself and a lot of our volunteers have had a real strong Commodore base, we do have a lot of Commodore machines, and I do believe we replaced the Commodore 64 that we've had for one reason or another, but you know, we've always had one and we always will have one of those on display.
They're pretty darn dependable too, huh?
Yeah, as long as you... One of the things that I've discovered that I really never knew so much about at the time using it was how different the power supplies are from machine to machine. Mm-hmm. Like you'd think they're, you can just swap one power supply out for another, but not necessarily. There's a big variance in those power supplies, and of course it all depends on how much crap you're plugging into the machine. So we have this, you know, multi-cartridge, you know, adapter that we want to plug. So we've actually had to basically put a beefier power supply onto the 64 because, you know, the standard one kind of isn't necessarily good enough, and sometimes weird things can happen. So that's been one thing that's been a bit of a challenge. And of course, some of the machines we've replaced as we've gotten better ones. So for example, the VIC-20, you know, we started out with, I think it might have been my VIC-20 that we had out there, and then this one came in that, you know, it was like a gift from the gods. It was like absolutely mint condition. Looks like it's never ever been used before. It probably wasn't. And so, you know, we replaced, you know, the one that we had with that one just because the keys work perfectly. It looks pristine. It just, and it still does, even though it's sitting out there in the museum now. It still looks like it's brand new. So I don't know. There's something about this VIC-20 that's, you know, magical. So, you know, so those types of things we've replaced from time to time. And of course, overall, we do swap out machines as we get, you know, new ones. So perfect example is just received a donation last week from someone who was involved. I don't know if you've ever played around with the Atari portfolio.
I have one.
Okay, so a guy that was involved in the development of that, that machine was actually developed in the UK. So even though Atari has their name on it, it was developed by a company in the UK. So a guy that worked on those machines has immigrated to Canada a few years ago, and he brought all of his stuff. He's actually planning on giving us a lot of the development stuff and background from the portfolio to add to our collection and make available to the public. So we'll document that online. But also, he has a lot of UK-based machines that, you know, we didn't have. We do have a few. We do have, like, the BBC Micro and stuff like that. But he's got, for example, the disk drive for an Amstrad. So we've got an Amstrad CPC 464, but we've never had the disk drive for it. He sent us one in the box. It looks like it's brand new. He's also sent us an Apricot PC, which we don't have.
Neat.
So those are the kind of things. So we try to, you know, put out a mixture of machines that people would have heard of, for example, you know, the Commodore 64 and the Ataris and the Cocos and stuff like that. And then we try to temper it with some machines that you've never heard of. So when you come out, you'll look and you'll go, oh, what's this? I've never heard of this before. And that's typically true of, you know, things like the UK machines. People may have heard of them, but not actually ever seen one in person, maybe only, you know, read about them in a magazine or something like that. So we do swap out the machines from time to time based upon what comes in. It's usually a case of a machine comes in and either myself or someone, you know, a volunteer says, oh, wow, this thing is very, very cool. And then we kind of look at, you know, a machine that's been out there for a while, and then we decide to kick it out, you know, say goodbye, your time here is over with, and we replace it with one of these new machines. So I think I already know which machine is going to get kicked out for the Apricot. So, but it's really, you know, we don't have a set policy. We just go based upon our own gut feeling and sort of, you know, the feedback we get from people. If people have looked at a machine and not really said anything about it, no one's really said, oh, I had one of these or whatever, then we don't feel bad about, you know, replacing it with something new.
Mm-hmm. I got you. All right. Well, I guess we're going to move into the show now. And let's see just a few comments here. See what we got. Is we got a few people watching us live, so that's good. And where's the? I just missed it. I see that question is answered already. Grumpier Thou had said, "What's the traffic like at the museum so far?" I guess you could.
So we do track our traffic. In terms of physical traffic to the museum, we have about 2,000 visitors a year.
That's
right,
pretty good.
Now, which is pretty good. Yeah. So it's typically on a Saturday that we're open. I would say we get anywhere from 20 people on a slow day to 50 to 75 on those days. And then on the Monday nights, it varies. A lot of times people, one of the purposes of the Monday night is for electronic recycling so people can drop stuff off. So a lot of times those people don't actually, you know, come out to the museum. They just come to the front part and just drop off their stuff. But we always try to encourage people to come in and go through the museum if they haven't been there. But yeah, that's basically how it's been. It's been pretty good. I mean, we would, I think, have a lot more traffic if we were open more hours. But again, it's one of those things where, you know, you have to sort of make sure you don't burn out your volunteers. Like a lot of times I thought, well, maybe I'll be open. Like I think even in the very beginning I had said, like I'm on record saying, you know, oh, we're going to be open one Saturday a month and hopefully as things go on we'll be open every Saturday or something like that. But I mean, I could not ask my volunteers to come out every Saturday. I certainly wouldn't get the same ones that come out. And even now, I mean, not everybody comes out every single Saturday because, you know what, life gets in the way and you have other things that you have to do sometimes. But, I mean, we've got a great crew now that really help out. I mean, like a lot of things, not every volunteer comes out every time, but we have sort of volunteers spread out around the province. And what's nice about that is that, you know, for example, we have volunteers near the Toronto area, which a lot of people, there's more people in Toronto. I mean, there's Brantford has, you know, 94,000-95,000 people in Toronto. You know, there's millions of people. So a lot of times if people want to donate something, I can send somebody out in the GTA area to pick it up, because a lot of people, you know, in larger cities obviously don't have cars, so they have a better public transit system. So, yeah, so that's, I hope that answers that question.
Someone else had asked, Mike Whalen asked, are you in the museum right now? I think it looks like you are.
I'm actually in my basement.
Oh, you're in your basement.
So I'm in my basement. Huh? So the museum actually... in a building in the back, so it's in a separate building. So what I'm in right now, my basement, I have the largest collection of video games in Canada.
Oh,
so
yeah, I heard that.
That's what you're seeing in the background. So the video games that are here are separate from the museum, but because they're basically on the same property, you can, if you come to the museum and I'm available and timing works, I will often take people through a tour of the basement so they can see those video games. But the stuff that's down here is strictly console games. There's no, you know, computer games or anything like that, except for the stuff that I catalog. So, you know, from this computer that I'm on right now, I actually every day start cataloging stuff. So pretty much every day, new stuff gets added to our site and our backlog. We have, you know, thousands of pieces of software that still haven't been cataloged. So there's lots of great stuff that keeps coming in every day. And I don't want people to stop dropping stuff off, but I don't know that I'll ever catch up. But that's okay. I'll keep trying.
All right, and we'll check back on comments in a little bit. So again, everyone, thanks for joining us. Earl is in Japan on a planned big holiday for him, so he was planned to be out this show. So Sid Bolton is our special guest co-host, and Carrington was supposed to be here, but his power is out, so he had emailed me again just like, I don't know, when was the last time? 2 minutes ago, just saying yes, his power's still out. So he's going to try to tune in on the show through his iPhone. That's
interesting.
All he has.
He can tell you that his power is out.
Yeah. What's he trying to pull? Well, he is, you know, on his iPhone. So.
Yeah. Sure.
So Carrington was supposed to host, and we usually have a host topic. So basically, we'll just leave that for when Carrington gets the host next show, since it'd be his turn. Me twice in a row. So let's jump to the first topic. Are you up? Yeah, you're on the document. Said okay. So
yes.
The first thing is, of course, most everyone's probably heard that Douglas Engelbart died this past week, and he was 88 years old. He's best known for as the inventor of the mouse. He certainly did much more than that. I think he died on the 2nd, which we're recording on the 7th. So I could be a day off or whatever, but in any case, you know, last few days. And there'll be a link in the show notes, of course, if you've never seen what's called the Mother of All Demos. We've talked about it on the show before. It's from 1968, and it was Douglas Engelbart giving a demonstration at the, trying to think what it was called, his institute. I have the article up. SRI for short. But he demonstrated a lot of just blow-you-away stuff for 1968. For one was the mouse. He also used something called a cording keyboard, and you see it in the video, where it's like 5 cords on his left hand. He's got his mouse in his right hand, keyboard in the middle, and then he could, I guess they're equivalent sort of to what keyboard commands are now, and pull-down menu shortcuts, where he could cord shortcuts to do things. And he demonstrated a lot of things that were recognizable but very rough to what we now use, everybody uses in the graphical user interface, but that's the beginning of it you see in this video and what him and his team developed. So you're real familiar with him?
Yeah, he, you know, amazing guy, definitely ahead of his time. I heard about this as well, and I did share the story about his passing through my network this week. It's one of those things where, you know, one person makes a contribution. I mean, we obviously, you know, people talk about, you know, Steve Jobs' contribution to the world, mm-hmm. and it's definitely significant. But sometimes people like this get unnoticed by the general public, and it's only, you know, geeks like us that sort of
right.
take notice of this. And so, I mean, I'm glad that it's something that we're talking about. I think the more people that know about it, the better. And, you know, it's kind of a shame. From what I understand as well, he never really made any money off that invention, which, you know, you hear about, you know, the guy that created the what do you call it, on your wiper blades, you know, when you have the time uh-huh. delay, made like something like 25 cents per vehicle that has that. So obviously made a lot of money. But could you imagine if Douglas had made a little royalty like that, he'd be a very rich man. But he didn't. One of those things that just happens in business sometimes. And, you know, it's kind of reminds me in a way like Ralph Baer, who for a long time did not get recognition for his contribution to the video mm-hmm. game industry and the many, many things that he did. Fortunately, that's been somewhat rectified over the last 10 years or so. But yeah, great guy, and yeah, just amazing. And, you know, it makes you wonder if he came up with something like that so long ago, you know, what kind of ideas he would have to, you know, today that right. maybe we'll be seeing 10 or 20 or 30 years from now. So people like that are always very, very interesting to talk to, and I wish I'd actually gotten a chance to talk to him in person.
Well, and I think I think it's very interesting. So the particular article we link off to is from Gizmodo, and it's a particularly nice piece about him. And, you know, he wanted to, and I read it, now it's been a little bit, you know, since I put the link in, we're doing the show, the Augmentation Research Center is something he founded. So he wanted to, he saw computers as something that could augment, you know, humans to do better work and be more creative and not just calculating machines. So, of course, things we take for granted nowadays. You know, he was a research scientist and he worked at a research institute, and certainly a lot of his work was pivotal to then the work that was done at Xerox PARC, for instance. And yeah. and more people are aware of some of those people, but even them, they're not as well known as, again, Apple and Steve Jobs and Bill Gates and other stuff, Windows and the Mac OS. But I think probably that's what happened is, you know, he didn't see it as a thing to profit from per se. And then you got the people over at Xerox PARC, and they built on that and improved it. And then I think they were frustrated that it was never made into a product. And then, of course, a lot of them, Alan Kay and a bunch of other people, they ended up going to both Microsoft and Apple. And, of course, then, you know, here we are today.
Yeah.
You know, Windows and Mac OS and Android, I guess, if you will, to a certain extent, and iOS. So definitely, if you have never checked out that particular demo, the mother of all demos, it is worth watching even a few minutes of. It's
yeah,
pretty amazing.
I mean, Xerox could be a whole other topic and story on its own, too, about a company who I actually was fortunate mm-hmm. enough to go to the Nexus Center, which is kind of the Canadian version of PARC, not nearly as advanced, and go walk around. And, you know, Xerox is an amazing company that does a lot of great things, but it seems like they never really themselves take advantage of the stuff that they help pioneer. They do have great products and everything, and I use a Xerox copier and manage several of them during my day job, but and they're great products, but I still think that it's one of those companies that has lost a lot of potential for things they possibly could have done over the years. I mean, obviously the whole thing with the graphical user interface and mm-hmm. and what happened with Jobs and the Mac is a good example. But there's other things too. I mean, they have really, really neat technologies involving paper, and you know, they should have been at the forefront of ebooks and stuff like that. And they build this great stuff, but nope. Somebody else always does it or takes their ideas and implements them better than they do. So it's, I don't know. I don't know what's going on with that company.
I think it's kind of interesting, though, too, and ironic how the whole basis of Xerox PARC, to a certain extent, and to the research, the work that was done there, and the virtual desktop and the graphical user interface and all that was, you know, they saw the end coming. You know, this is in the early 70s. 40 years ago, that, you know, paper was going to go away one day. Our entire business is based on it. What are we going to do?
Yeah.
But here they are still around, and there's more paper than ever. Their entire business is still based on paper, pretty much.
Yeah, so computers just make it easier to make prettier paper.
And I almost argue it generates more paper.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, so here's a
that all started with the print shop. If it hadn't have been from that darn print shop program.
Wow. That was around a long time, wasn't it?
Yeah, 1984 is when Print Shop came out, and I remember that program when it first did come out, and how how it was so amazing, you know, to print a greeting card and then, you know, send it to someone or print, you know, print banners with the old fanfold tractor-fed paper. I mean, that was great stuff. And it was really interesting to walk into a room and see, you know, happy birthday, Bob, with, you know, some really terrible pixelated message. But it was just cool because, you know, before that, everything was all, you know, crayons and pencil drawings and I can't draw. So
and it got really nice over the years. It was improved and improved, and then, of course, it was just surpassed.
Yeah, I think the print shop version 75 came out before they finally folded it into something else, I think.
I think, like, a lot of things the internet killed, like, then you just get all kinds of free clip art and do all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, remember the clip art CDs? Oh,
mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
Just sell those things in, like, 20 packs. Oh, so glad they're gone. Bye-bye.
So we're going to move into our next item of interest, and this is actually Sid, this is your story. So it's not a current story. It happened a few years ago.
Yeah.
So it's kind of back to your own future stuff. So tell us about this, the VIC-20 and the first ever tweet.
So yeah, I wanted to the story sort of was really hot for a while, and of course, as all things kind of fades into obscurity. But the interesting thing is that in some ways it hasn't died. So I'm always trying to come up with ideas for how to promote the museum because, you know, we're not for profit. We have no money, like so many other museums in the world that do great things. And so I always find it's a challenge to, you know, sort of generate news around what you're doing and bring awareness to the general public, especially with computer stuff. And so, of course, social media was hot in 2009 when I first came up with this idea, but it certainly wasn't quite as hot as it has become. And Twitter was not new, but it was relatively new in terms of being adopted by everybody. Still seeing a lot of people going, I don't get it. Of course, a lot of people still say that today about Twitter. But anyways, I came up with the idea of trying to see if I could get one of our retro computers to go on Twitter. And one of the things that attracted me to Twitter from that sense was the fact that, of course, it's a very minimalist platform, you know, with 140 characters and stuff like that. And I thought, well, you know, I think most of the computers we have can handle 140 characters. So I thought about the computers that we had. I thought about the worst one in terms of a technical specification, the absolutely worst computer that I could possibly make this happen on. That happened to be the VIC-20, you know, with a 22-column display. You know, 140 characters would fit, but it would certainly be on multiple lines. And, you know, with 5K of RAM, you don't have a lot to work with in terms of writing some code. Plus, I used to write stuff on the VIC-20, so I thought I'd be comfortable writing the code. So at the end of the day, we were able to get an unexpanded VIC-20 to communicate over Twitter. It did need some help. There's no direct Ethernet on the VIC-20, so we ended up using the serial port to get that message out. And then, of course, Twitter has some pretty complicated stuff in terms of security that the VIC wouldn't be able to handle. So we did have to basically send the message out in a wrapper and have it go out. But still, using the VIC-20 to send out messages and have the VIC-20 receive messages. And so I started working on the code in 2009, and then kind of lost a little bit of interest in it, and then I came back to it in 2010. And so in February, we actually did a sort of a launch, and we had that VIC-20 tweet, and we, for several open houses after that, we made it available for the general public to come in, use their username and password, and send out tweet messages. And so I noticed that in the UK, they had one of the machines, it might have been the Acorn or something like that, also go on Twitter, but it's still a much more powerful computer than the VIC-20. So I believe, as far as I know, that we still hold the record for the oldest computer to go on Twitter, with the VIC-20, of course, being circa 1982 or 81. So really old, obviously, and a lot of people couldn't believe that we were doing it. And it was kind of interesting, you know, the story, you know, Leo Laporte talked about it actually on one of his shows, which was great, considering that's one of the earliest tech podcasts I've ever listened to and watched.
So I remember, I mean, I definitely remember hearing about it. I was just looking to see if we talked about it on this show, but our first show was in October of 2010, so So it was
so
after,
would have been
yeah.
old news by then. So
yeah, but I remember hearing about it, definitely.
So, well, that's good. I mean, it's always, like I said, a challenge to get the word out about what we're doing. And so I just thought I'd bring it back up as kind of one of those things where I think it's still an interesting thing to be able to do that. And sort of it's more about, I guess, more of the point I'm trying to make is it's still neat to see old computers have usefulness in today's environments. And I think a lot of times, a lot of people, you know, come to me and say, you know, why are we using these old computers to do this, whatever? And it's like, you know what? Computers today are really no different than computers from the day. We still do the same things, with the exception of being able to use the internet the way we do. We still, mm-hmm. we play games, we communicate with other people, whether it's through writing letters in a word processor or using online. We do our taxes, you know, and we mess around with them. It's really no different. You know, obviously the games are you know, incredible today versus what they were graphically and all that kind of stuff. But at the end of the day, we're still doing the same stuff. So that's why it's kind of fun to find useful things for old technology. And that's why, you know, I don't know, I always love those kinds of stories in the news is, you know, when people are still using, you know, an old computer. Like when I found out, for example, that when we had that big power outage years ago that happened across, what, half of North America, a lot of the power companies were using Atari STs to manage the power. And I was surprised. And it's just because, you know, a lot of times somebody in the industry picks a platform, writes some code for it, and then people in the industry talk and say, yeah, we could use that. And so they, of course, you know, adopt that platform and that software, and suddenly this stuff spreads. And a lot of times the general public doesn't have any clue that, you know, and I think if you look in your own city, you may find that a lot of the services and things that you rely on are actually running with extremely old technology. So I just find those kinds of stories really, really interesting.
And Michael Sternberg has asked, has Twitter closed off their API now? Is this something you could do again?
Yeah, so basically what happened is at one point in time, initially it worked just fine, and then I got a notice saying that, you know, we had to, of course, because of improved security, we had to make some changes to our code, which I did do. And so initially it worked, then it stopped working a few months later as Twitter made some changes. And then the last time I tried it, which was a few months ago, again, it didn't work. So I think the same thing has happened. I think what happened to us last time was Twitter made an exception for us and allowed us with this particular API key that we had to use this, and now they've closed that out again. Would it happen again? Probably not. If I found the right person at Twitter, could I get them to make an exception? Maybe, maybe not. I don't know. But I haven't tried again. I should. I should follow back up with it again because it'd be really cool to get it going again. So I will definitely look into it and see what happens, and I'll share my results with everyone and see what happens because it'd be cool to get it going again. I mean, you know, I understand the need for the security and stuff like that, but I think given the closed environment and what we're doing, I don't think it should be a big deal. Really, you know, I wasn't, I did make sure, and this was kind of an interesting thing when I'm writing the code, right? Like, if you look at a modern day operating system, there's features for, you know, if you put a text box into a web browser or a computer program, you can say this is a password so that it shows just asterisks or whatever. The VIC-20 didn't have that. I actually had to write my own routine to put asterisks on the password when people were typing it in. So because I didn't want people's passwords, obviously, to be shown on the screen, even on the VIC-20. So I did do some stuff to prevent that. And, of course, it was closed and secure still because the password just, you know, was in a closed environment going from the VIC-20 out through RS-232 and then put into a proper wrapper and encrypted. So the passwords were still safe. So hopefully, if I explain all that and follow it up with proof, that maybe they'll consider letting us use it again.
Hmm. Okay. Well, so let's see. Looking at our show doc, only me and you can see. So we're going to skip Carrington's items because he can, of course, do this on the next show.
Even the War Games one?
Oh, he blew it. You want to talk about it? We can talk about it.
Sure.
The How about I'll let you take this one? So let's see. Wargames MSI is up for sale again.
All right. So I know, I think it was the last episode or one of the episodes you did, you were talking about the Altair in the background, right? You were talking about
the remakes
and so on. So the MSI 8080, for those that don't know, was a very similar machine that came out just within months of the Altair. And so great machine. It's wonderful. We actually have one in the museum. It's the oldest, you know, full computer that we have running. And so what's happened is, for those that don't know, and if you're into vintage computing, if you haven't seen War Games with Matthew Broderick and Ali Sheedy, then you're really missing out. It's one of my favorite movies of all time. And in the film, David Lightman, the character played by Broderick, uses a computer to break into the basically computers at NORAD. The machine's called the Whopper. And the home computer that he has was something that it's an MSI. And basically, I actually talked to, believe it or not, I talked to John Badham, the director of the film. And I was asking him about sort of some of the questions about using the MSI. And he sort of said that, like a lot of movies, they wanted to use a computer that people could tell it was a computer, but it wasn't a computer that the average person would have at home. And indeed,
because it's actually pretty out of date, by 1983.
Yeah, it was. And of course, the machine that was actually on the screen was the MSI, but the computer screen was not actually being driven by an MSI. So it was being driven by a much more advanced computer at the time. So the whole point of the story that's happening right now is that the actual prop that was used in the film, including the acoustic coupler modem, which, by the way, even at that point in time when the movie came out, acoustic coupler modems were not the norm. Commodore had released the world's first sub-$100 modem with the VIC modem, and it was a direct line modem. And most modem manufacturers by that time had also were releasing modems that were connecting directly into the phone line. And so, again, the point of the movie and using the acoustic coupler modem was, for those that didn't know anything about computers, it was good for film, it was good for the big screen, and it kind of gave the idea that a computer was connecting to a phone line. So this actual...
Right. I think that's what it did, is people knew, oh, he's now connecting, he's putting the phone on the computer, it's now connecting...
Yeah, because it's not
computers,
as sexy
right?
to just, you know, go into a terminal program and start going, and oh, like, because you don't really see anything, right? You look down, it's like the modem's connected into the phone line.
Right.
And
so people
came
to understand what that meant, like movies like Hackers, I guess, in 96, that was, 95, and then you just got the modem noise. And then people knew, I know what, now it's connecting.
Yeah, and today, I mean, if you ask, what I'll say to most people is, when we talk about programs stored on cassette tape, I'll say to them, do you know what a fax machine sounds like? And pretty much most people now know that squawking sound. But back then, nobody really understood it. And even the sound that they used in the movie wasn't a true proper tone sound. It was a little, it was Hollywoodized. But anyways, so the actual prop used in the film with all the proper providence that goes with it is up for sale. And it was up for sale before. I remember years ago when...
2 years ago, I think, approximately, because I looked it up when I first heard about this.
Yeah, I remember it being up for sale. And a lot of people actually ask me, because when they come to the museum and you look at our MSI, you can actually... I have a picture of... David Lightman using it, or Matthew Broderick and Ali Sheedy using it, to sort of say to people, this was the computer that they used in War Games. And people, when they look at the image, they go, yeah, I remember that movie. And then some people will say to me, so this is the actual computer? I'm like, no. Well, yes and no. It's not the one that was actually shot for the film, but it is the same model. And so, I wish that we actually had, the one, but I think there was, according to this article, they're valuing it at about $25,000 for this. And, while it would be a great piece of history to own, I don't know about you, but I don't have an extra $25,000 laying around to have something ultra cool. But you know what? For a lot of rich Silicon Valley types, maybe they've got the cash to throw away.
Well, and, everything to find out is the reason he can't. So he was going to have it auctioned off at Christie's, and in New York, I guess. I'm not sure where he is. Maybe he's in California, perhaps. But then he canceled it sort of last minute because he was concerned about the shipping and all that stuff. And it may even speak about that in this particular article. But anyway, there's a lot of story here. I don't know all the background. But his name is Thomas Todd Fisher. And basically, somewhere late in the late 70s, maybe early 80s or something, he bought the remnants of the MSI company. And there's a whole story, interesting story there, where the guy that founded MSI actually went on to found Computerland. And I have a book about it called Once Upon a Time in Computerland. Really good read. And you can buy it real cheap, used. But then if you go to his website, you go to MSI, I think it's MSI.net, for a lot of years he was going to make an MSI, a brand new MSI.
Yes, I remember that.
MSI 2 or whatever?
The Altair, yeah.
With USB and like where you can run modern, I went to MSI.com, where you can run modern stuff with it as well. And that all and did some stuff, and anyway. So here's something now on MSI.net where it shows that he's now selling this. It doesn't give like a date though. Like, you know, I guess just as soon as he gets the highest offer, he accepts it. Anyway, I kind of think he could potentially get more than $25,000, me personally, because of the it's part in the movie. And then, you know, Christie's has an auction going right now. It's going to end in 2 days where they have an Apple One, and they've got some other interesting old computers. We mentioned it on the last show. I don't know why he doesn't maybe consider doing that now, where it's an online Christie's auction. So, or even eBay. I don't know why wouldn't you want to use eBay. I think you could get more attention and potentially more money for it, in my opinion.
Well, yeah, I mean, if he had something that people could look at and could participate in, more people would. The type of people that are going to be interested in this are going to be tech type people. So you want to use things like online auctions. This isn't, you know, you can understand if it was something that was an old school item, selling it in an old school way makes sense. But this is, although it's an old school computer, it's still a computer. It's still a piece of technology. And so you should be using technology to sell it, because that's where your audience is going to be and what they're going to use. And certainly, you know, computer people are the type that are going to share computer stories. So, yeah, it doesn't make sense to not do it that way. I think one of the things was, it mentions in there that the disk drive did not, the original disk 8-inch disk drives actually is what they were, did not survive the initial shipping that went somewhere, whether when he bought the assets of MSI or whatever. So that's not included, or at least it's not included working. And I think, you know, it mentions in there that he stopped the auction because I think the highest bidder at the time or something was someone from London, and he was concerned about the machine not surviving shipping. But you know what? At those rates, insure it, but also
have the buyer insure it.
It's not hard to pack something like that very well to survive something like that. We have the technology today. It's not the shipping's technology of 1976. It's, you know, we've got this thing called foam. It works pretty well if you do it properly. I mean, there is a proper way to pack things so they don't get damaged. So when you're talking about that much money, I don't see why you wouldn't take the extra effort to make sure it doesn't get damaged and not worry about it. And you're right. I mean, just insure it. Pack it properly and insure it, and then that's the end of the story. So, I mean, obviously if it got destroyed, that would be the end of, you know, a piece that can't be replaced. But at the same time, if he's willing to let it go, then he's got to be willing to let it go all the way.
So it'll be interesting to try to follow this and see if there's, you know, whether if he sells it, do we ever hear about it or how much it went for, or, you know, we'll see what happens. Maybe moving forward. So, all right.
Bye, MSI.
The next item here is something in passing. It's kind of interesting. It's called it's an article at Mashable called 12 Badass American Inventions That Changed History. So I thought we could discuss that for a few minutes.
Especially on a Canadian podcast.
Yeah. American inventions. So let's see. The first one, well, actually, I think the first one grabbed me too, which is, in fact, come on. I can't scroll down here. All right, I'm having technical difficulties. All right, here we go. Scroll. Well, I see the first thing here is a picture of the Saturn V. Okay, so then it goes down anyway. So the first thing is the transistor. So definitely invented at Bell Labs. And, yeah, so an American invention. Certainly that incredibly changed that was extremely important and significant. Do we need to discuss?
Well, that? I mean, just even to talk about how it relates to the CPU. I mean, we have a display at the museum that shows, you know, basically one of the first Intel CPUs. We picked Intel just for this particular display just because a lot of people recognize that more than, say, a Motorola mm-hmm. CPU. But, 29,000 transistors in an early 8088. And, even I think the we don't even have that up to date. I think the last CPU we have in there is from 2006 and 150 million transistors roughly in the same place, although the outer package of CPUs has changed. Really the amount of space and the amount of silicon that they use is not that different. And just amazing to see something that replaced something so big back in the day, how it itself over the last 30 years has just, changed so much. And I think one of the big problems people have with vintage computers and understanding vintage computing in general is that as humans, we're very visual, and it's hard to see sometimes, so I can say to you, it went from 29,000 to 150 million, but yeah, that's a number. It's two numbers. To actually see it, that makes it a little bit better for people to understand. And so those are the kinds of things we're trying to do is to really get people to understand the significance that we're talking about. And the transistor, I mean, such an amazing thing that really without it, where would we be today? Everything that we have has virtually a computer in it today. Everything from your washing machine, your coffee maker, your phone, everything. So they all have transistors in them.
So obviously it made integrated circuits possible, but even, the big thing maybe that most consumers saw as from this in the 50s and the 60s was the transistor radio. Small, transportable, pocket-sized radios mostly, but other electronics and so on. And I'm not going to go through the whole thing because a lot of it's not specifically computers, but the number two is Voyager 1. Anyway, check out the article. Number three, so again, these are the 12 greatest, made per, according to this, American inventions. Number three is the Saturn V rocket, which is amazing. I'm a huge fan of NASA, especially the Apollo missions. The father of our rocket program was Wernher von Braun, a captured German scientist, certainly American. Father of our American space industry, but he was a German, and all of our rockets were based on his V2 technology, so it's kind of German American perhaps. But anyway, it's the, and there's some other reasons I went down here. The
well, it's interesting that this list contains something like ARPANET, which of course is the origins of the internet, and we all know what an amazing thing that is. But the Roomba is on there too.
Yeah. And other than the funny video with the cat on it, is hilarious. But yeah, the Roomba.
Well, it does make a good point about algorithms and navigation and stuff like that. Which, really, if you think about it, that technology, origins of that technology are going to be the stuff that's actually in things like Google being able to automatically drive our cars and stuff like that. And so it is kind of a funny thing when you first see it, but they do give a bit of an explanation as to why it's there. But it's kind of interesting that it is, you just see ARPANET and Roomba. And when you think about the contributions to the world, clean carpets and the internet, I don't know. Seems weird.
So to me, the two big standouts here is number 8. Well, actually, let me scroll down because it goes to 12. So yeah, number 12 is 3D printing, which is obviously huge and in its infancy about its future and what's going to happen with it. Number 11 is the Macintosh. Very significant, obviously, but it's kind of, there's more to that than just the Macintosh.
Yeah, absolutely.
But anyway, number 8 is the ARPANET, which, tying in with like Douglas Engelbart and SRI, I think his computer is like the second node on the ARPANET, which obviously became the DARPANET and then the Internet. So the beginnings of, the Internet is probably the most significant American invention, I guess, in my opinion, out of anything. Of course, you had to have computers behind that. But number 10 is also interesting because it's about Sketchpad. And I think we spoke about Ivan Sutherland on the show recently. So he was the guy in the early 60s behind the Sketchpad, which was sort of the first computer system that utilized somebody interacting with it visually by using a light pen on a screen. And it was early predecessor of CAD, And but it also a lot of his work was worked into what Douglas Engelbart did at SRI, and then of course Xerox PARC and GYs and so on. So it's sort of a generic list, really, though. Anybody can make up a list. Why 12? Also, cars aren't even on there. And I don't guess Americans invented cars, but certainly, Ford sort of invented the mass-produced automobile. That changed things pretty drastically, didn't it?
Absolutely. And if you look at, it's funny. I always use cars when I'm talking about computers and how... If you look at how far computers have come in 30 years versus how far cars have come, if you pick pretty much any 30-year period, there's certainly not nearly as much advancement in cars as there are in computers. But, of course, the interesting thing about that analogy, as time has gone on and as cars have become full of computers, their advancement has actually been accelerated by the computer itself, which is part of my initial argument, which is kind of a strange thing to try and think about. But it's amazing how that's gone along. But, yeah, I mean, you could argue that the car and its effect on transportation and how everything we do, from consumer goods to the groceries that we buy and everything else, comes down to how well and how easily and how cost effectively can we transport stuff around the world and trade. I mean, if you think about the impact on trade alone, it's amazing what the car and vehicles have done. So I don't know why that's not on there, but there must be a reason. But again, sometimes when they make a list like this, they don't think of everything. Maybe that it's not within their scope. So
yeah, it's kind of a fluffy topic, but it's interesting. Good discussion.
Yeah, it's definitely. I always like lists like this. They're interesting, and they definitely make good discussion points as well.
One thing. I'll say about cars, so we don't want to spend too much time on that, but we just recently bought a new car, and our 18-year-old son bought one of our other cars, so that's sort of what drove that. But, it seems to me that, you have some of the best cars made, and obviously, if you list cars, you have, somewhere there's the worst car made, I guess, nowadays. But, it seems to me that pretty much any automobile, American, mostly we have, American automobiles, German automobiles, Japanese, Korean. I know there's, Swedish, I guess, Saabs, and obviously there's other manufacturers, but the main ones. There's very few bad cars anymore. So that says a lot, too, about the mechanical engineering, which computers have drove that as well, and the engineering and the design and the fit and the function of everything. But, there's very few just really bad cars anymore. Whatever
it's
the
true.
Cheapest car...
To tie it back into our main topic, the same thing sort of happened, if you remember, when 3.5-inch floppy disks first came out? There were the very, very expensive brand name ones. I remember paying, $50, $60, $70 for a box of 10 Maxell floppies, which were always very, very good. And then, of course, it was $40 for the white, box generic brand, which... were really crappy. Honestly, they sometimes, they didn't work so well, and they were definitely cheap. They, you might have got one bad one out of the 10 or whatever, but they were so much cheaper, right? But the thing is that after a couple of years,
almost never got a bad
all
one.
All the floppies were good. It didn't matter if you bought the worst possible brand; they all worked. And and the computer itself, I don't think of any other industry, and of course, computers themselves would have been the reason why those manufacturing processes improved. And I don't think there's any other industry that improves upon itself. And even, every single computer that we have today has been made through advancements made possible by previous computers that came along. So I don't think there's anything else that sort of can make that claim to fame. We wouldn't have the amount of, density and transistors and complexity and stuff that we have if it wasn't for the computer itself. So it's kind of a strange thing how these computers build them, are used to make themselves better. And it's true with manufacturing, too. The computers have really made an impact there as well. So.
And Sid, by the way, I have this pack of 50 brand-new Imation diskettes. Would you be interested?
Wow, look at that. It's not just one pack. It's actually
I just happen to have these.
Of course you do.
This was a find at my job recently, and of course there's not one single computer there that has a disk drive.
Wow.
So, you know, these are in like the storage thing for who knows how long.
You wouldn't believe it. Friday at my work, I work for a couple of pharmaceutical companies. I run the IT department, and one of the people came in and said, I need a floppy disk.
Why?
What? And he's like, we need it for the FedEx computer. Something happened with the FedEx computer, and we need to download the file onto a floppy. I'm like, I can actually help you. I keep some of that stuff around, right? I've got this old stuff at work still. So yeah. There you go. I needed a floppy disk on Friday for a modern day little
problem. How old was that FedEx machine?
You know, I don't know. I wasn't there when it was first put in, but man, I got to go take a look at that thing because it's got to be pretty old. Although, I mean, the machine that I was using myself was it's fairly old now, but maybe 5 or 6 year old Dell. It had a floppy drive installed in it that I'd never actually used.
Oh, a desktop, I guess. Yeah.
So, yeah. But, you know, I still keep a USB floppy drive, 3.5-inch floppy around. So, and there's a thing, you know, for anybody listening, watching, or whatever, we're still looking for, I know this has been a topic that I haven't looked at it up in a while, so maybe someone solved this problem, but there's obviously lots of choices on USB 3.5-inch disk drives, but I still don't think, probably just because the demand for it would probably be about 50 pieces worldwide, but still would love to have a 5.25-inch USB drive, so if anyone's, you know, figured out how to make that work or make that happen, we'd be interested in selling that because people ask us all the time. We actually have machines that have, of course, both on them, and we do offer that service for people. So if you have old disks and you want them converted, that's fine. But, I mean, we have to go through a process, right? We convert it from 5.25 to 3.5, then 3.5 on the USB over and so on. But it would be kind of cool to have a USB 5.25-inch drive. I think there's a market. Like I said, it's about 50 pieces, so it's not a big market. But if anyone has ever solved that problem, please let me know.
All right. So let's see. Our last item here is, so Sid, I'll let you take this, is Yahoo is about to close one-time Google rival Alta Vista. So I don't know if anybody, you'd heard about that?
Other people? I can't believe it was still going.
Yeah, I know. And it's a shame because I remember I loved it for a long time, and I actually used it for a good while.
I used to use it myself, and I was really, really surprised to see that it was actually still up.
Today's the last day you can use it. They're closing it down tomorrow, so get on Alta Vista.
Yeah, get on there and check it out because, you know, the big thing about, you know, Alta Vista that made it sort of really interesting at the time was, for those that have been around the World Wide Web essentially since its inception or since the early days, you'll remember that, you know, the ability to find out what was out there on the internet, on the web, was really, really tough. And of course, you know, Yahoo rose to great popularity. However, in the very beginning days, it was completely one of the reasons why it was so great was also the reason why it had such problems, and that was that everything on there had to be verified by a human and everything. And so, you know, Alta Vista was great because it did this automatic indexing where it was searching millions of pages long before, you know, any other search engine technology had caught up to that. So I remember very fondly using it. Like I said, kind of surprised that it was even still around. I also used to use InfoSeek. I don't know if you remember InfoSeek, but I before that was rolled into Disney, of all places, bought that search engine.
Theirs was called the Go Network, wasn't it? I think if you go to Disney,
something like
comes
that.
Up. Excuse me, with the Go in there. InfoSeek was a web crawler, and there was... I'm with it. I don't see it in there anymore. I know for the longest time you went to anything Disney and it still had the Go in there. And
yeah, exactly.
What was the other one? Excite?
Yeah, Excite was...
Hotbot. That's the one I said.
You know,
that was
basically a Hotbot, yeah. Hotbot was, again, had bot right in the name because it was a robot crawler that went through the web. But of course, you know, even back then, I do remember when Google first opened and, you know, was on beta for what seemed like forever. But yeah, it's interesting. And I mean, for those that don't know, you know, the whole history of Google, I mean, it was originally not intended to be a mainstream search engine itself. It was meant to be sort of the back end engine of a company like Yahoo. And, you know, in fact, for a while, Yahoo did use Google technology to combine its human done results with automated results from Google and brought together sort of a hybrid. And even for a time, that was great as well. And it was wonderful. And of course, things changed drastically, and we all know what happened after that. But I guess what's you make something funny and say how do you say I can't remember the exact expression, but we're gonna say hasta la vista, alta vista, or something like that, right? I can't believe it's going away. I can't believe it was still around. So I've had double shocks in one day. It's here. It's gone.
Just to close out the topic too is, remember, for the longest time in the early days, I mean, Yahoo was everything. And I remember how frustrated I got. So when I first got my own domain, classiccomputing.com, sometime in 98 or whatever, and I wasn't very good at it, but I tried to have a web page. I could never get listed on Yahoo because, you know, you had to have a person list you. They weren't a search engine. They were what was the right word for that? You know, catalog or whatever, and I could never get listed on it. And basically, you didn't exist if you weren't on, you know, Yahoo.
Yeah, I was fortunate. I had a site for classic computers. Not a separate site, but it was part of one of my own pages. I can't remember the exact page I had, but it was like a personal page on the Freenet. I was involved in a Freenet up here, and I had a page about video games, and it actually got listed. And after, it was amazing the amount of traffic that I got and continued to get for years after. So it was pretty
cool. Yeah, if you're on there,
pretty cool.
You're big time.
You were in. And then, of course, you know, if you were commercial, well, you had to pay. So
I know it's a whole other discussion, too, about so AltaVista was, you know, started by DEC in digital, then it was acquired by Compaq and then HP, and then I know according to the article they were sold like five other times. They were, you know, so that obviously didn't help them out very much either.
Nobody wanted that bad child.
And what happened, you know, what happened to Compaq and DEC ultimately, or DEC especially, wasn't too good either.
Look inside today's PCs. You'll find something pretty amazing. The Intel Pentium processor. It gives PC software more life, more action, more energy. So if you want your PC software to really move, make sure your PC has the Intel Pentium processor. Imagine video like you see in the movies. Graphics you want to reach out and touch. Numbers that fall into place instantly. So things go faster at work, learning's more fun, and games are far more realistic. It's amazing what you can do with an Intel Pentium processor.
So we're going to move into our auction items. We're not going to have a gift idea because, again, that was Carrington's choice, and he's not able to host. So let's start off with we will cover Carrington's, though. He'll have to pick another one next show. So I picked a 1970s Royal V64 computer with keyboard. It's just an unusual Apple II clone I stumbled on. I thought it was pretty neat. I don't know anything about it. Currently has 4 days and 4 hours left. So, again, it's where is it? It's in Pasadena, California. It's about $60 shipping to me in Georgia if I was to get it. So it's got to be cheaper almost anywhere else or no more, except for Canada maybe. And so it's
$64.50 by.
That's not bad.
No, it's not bad.
So it has one bid at $199.99, and it's pretty interesting looking. So it's actually a separate keyboard to the case, kind of a generic case, but interesting. Looks to be metal.
I've never seen that particular clone before. It always amazes me how many of these clones are out there.
Mm-hmm.
It really, really does. Like, the amount of effort that was put into copying Apple's products back then, absolutely incredible. We have a really cool clone at the museum called the Orange Computer.
Uh-huh. I've seen one of those before.
Yeah, it's really cool. And that was actually Canadian made, although it did sell a little bit into the U.S. But it's very neat looking. This one's I will give it props that it's a little better looking than a lot of the clones I've seen. Most of them, you know, tend to be sort of almost clones of themselves. You know, clones of clones are all very sort of generic looking in a sort of a very simple metal, you know, case with the wood grain sides. But this one actually looks like there was a little bit of design effort put into it, and certainly the keyboard looks pretty cool.
The keyboard looks like it's from maybe a terminal or something.
Something, yeah. It definitely looks a little bit even more advanced than the Apple was at the time.
Oh, yeah. So anyway, check that out. We'll see how it does. Let's see. The monitor and disk drive are not included. Okay, right. So even though it's in a case like that, it didn't have a disk drive built into it. Of course, you can get those things pretty cheap. All right, so why don't you take it away? You've got... Commodore CBM B128.
Yeah, so the reason I wanted to talk about this one was, this is an auction for a Commodore B128, and a lot of people may not know the B128 because it's actually a very rare Commodore mm-hmm. computer. It's kind of interesting. It's one of those computers that Commodore released that didn't. It was kind of had a bit of an identity crisis. It doesn't know whether it wants to be, a home computer or a business computer. It contained an 80-column display. So the best way to describe it, it's kind of a mashup between a PET and a Commodore 64. It has the limited graphics of the PET, but the 80-column screen that was sort of required by business. But it also featured, oddly enough, the 6581 SID chip, which was the sound interface device chip of the Commodore 64, which arguably still the best 8-bit computer sound chip ever made. So it's got this great sound and really, really crappy graphics. So kind of a weird thing. But also interesting to note is that the case was designed by someone who either worked for or was an ex-designer for Porsche. So it's a very beautiful computer to see it in person. The pictures here, most of them are too close to really give you a good sense of the nice round curves and beautiful aesthetic appeal of this computer. But the one note I wanted to make about this auction at $599, I don't know whether it's worth that or not, but it seems to be one of these typical phenomenons that happen a lot of time on eBay where people assume that rare means pricey. And I see there at $599, obviously there's nobody's bought it yet. Someone did make an offer,
yeah.
And clearly that offer has been rejected. The offer was probably closer to the real value. I would peg the actual value of something like this closer to the $300 mark, which is still a lot of money, honestly, for an old computer like this that especially doesn't have a lot of software, doesn't have a lot of support. It's more of if you're a Commodore fanatic and you got to have something like this, this might be your auction. But I think it's a little overpriced. But I don't know what you think about that, but I certainly... We have one. We have one in the museum. You can actually, if anyone's interested and they're in, you know, not too far from us, come visit us. You can actually play with the one that we have and see what it's like. But, you know, we've struggled to have anything software-wise work on it. So unless you're just planning on having it sit there and not do a whole lot, this may not be the machine for you. But it's definitely a rarer Commodore piece. So if you're a Commodore fanatic, this might be an option for you.
Do you have the matching display for yours? It had its own special display, didn't it?
Only certain models. The CBM 256 model had a built-in display. This one didn't come with a display. It has a standard 5-DIN pin connector on the back, which would allow you to plug it into anything, but the graphics are only monochrome. So in our case, I think we had it plugged into a 1701, but that's kind of overkill because, of course, it doesn't do color. So we just plugged it in, I think, to a Zenith monochrome display.
Yeah, so, I thought
there is a model that does have a swivel monitor on top. But
yeah,
it's
not
curvy, this particular one.
Sort of curvy looking, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, maybe 600 is kind of a lot. It is. They are fairly rare, as far as I know, though.
Yeah, but like I said, this is a case where I don't know that rare necessarily equates to high value.
No,
because
it has to be demand.
It's If it did more, if it was more interesting, if you could do neat things with it, I would say, yeah, maybe it is worth it. But it's one of those computers you're going to get it, and you're not going to be able to do much with it,
mm-hmm.
you know, at the end of the day. So I don't know if it's worth an ornament on your desk is worth $600. So
let's see. What did Carrington pick? Again, since, you know, it's an auction, it's going to end, and, you know, he'll have to pick something else next show. So he picked the Microtech Mice-2 8-bit CPU emulation system, the 6502 and Z80 boards, and more. So it only has, like, a little over 3.5 hours left. It's up to $294.10.
Wow.
Seattle, Wisconsin. So that's kind of interesting. So is it for the Apple II? So it's got a Z80 and a 6502. What is it for, Frank? Microtech. That's usually an Apple stuff, right?
Yes. And, yeah, it looks like, wow. So the one of the things that makes it special is that it was acquired directly from one of the head developers of the Franklin, which was, of course, the Apple clone. So that's sort of where... I guess maybe there's some value there. Whether the proper provenances are, I don't know. But yeah, it's kind of interesting.
I'm trying to see what it goes into. Because look at the board itself. See, like, the blue connectors things, and where is it? It's not an Apple II board. I mean,
no, it's not. It might actually just be if you look at.
It's odd.
It might actually just be its own board, you know, system itself. It may not plug into anything at all. I think it's like an emulator that allows you to do development.
Hmm.
So I think that's what it is.
Yeah.
So that would be
wish
my
guess.
Anyways.
Picture. I wish I could look at, like, the manual or something. Well, so it's got 19 bids. So I mean, there's some demand for it.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty interesting.
Well, yeah, this kind of development stuff is quite rare and was never really, you know, sold in big numbers. So it's going to be one of those things that, yeah, you see it on here, but you're probably not going to see it again. So, yeah, kind of interesting. Hmm. But definitely has a very, you know, specific type of audience.
Maybe next show, Carrington can just speak to why he picked that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
He's supposed to be watching the show. Why aren't you commenting, Carrington?
Because he's got no power.
He's got an iPhone. No excuse.
Maybe he ran the power dry, Colin.
Well, that's it. Pretty much for the show. We have some closing shots. You got any closing shots? Well, actually, let me add one for Carrington. Well, actually... his closing shots are going to be about Kansas Fest, but actually we're going to have a show which starts on the 23rd of this month, but our next show is on the 21st, I think. Yeah, so unless he can't make it, as far as I know, he can make it, so we should have one more show before he leaves for Kansas Fest so we can talk about it. Anyway, Kansas Fest starts on July 23rd. If you're interested, check out Kansas Fest. You going to Kansas Fest?
No, I'm not, unfortunately.
Have you ever been to any of the shows?
Like, you know, I haven't really gone to any, like, vintage computing festivals or anything like that. I have some volunteers that have, but mm-hmm. I haven't myself. I don't know. It's one of those things where I go to the Commodore shows in Toronto that T-Pug still has their show.
Oh, yeah.
World of Commodore every year.
We're trying to get Carrington to go.
yeah. So, I mean, he's probably come by because I've had a booth there a few times.
No, he didn't.
Oh, he didn't?
He's an Apple guy.
Oh, right. Yeah, see, the fighting still exists even today. But, yeah, I definitely should go to something like that, and I'm sure I will in the future. But for me, I just mentioned to people to just check out the museum website at pcmuseum.ca. Explore our stuff. There's a lot of content that's I got to change our website because there's lots of content that's hidden within. If when you go to the site at the navigation bar, there's if you go to the resources tab and click on collections, there's lots of stuff still to come in a lot of these areas, but we do have a lot of things inside there, especially under software. And our computer list, not complete at all. We have over 1,000 computers in our inventory, and most of them haven't been cataloged yet. But do check out our software sections, especially you know, a lot of stuff under DOS and Commodore 64 and Atari 8-bit are pretty fleshed out. But the other thing that is kind of cool about our website that there's tons of websites about vintage computer stuff and whatever, but one of the things that we do particularly well, if you go to that resources section and click on the companies tab, you will see a lot of companies that have been cataloged by us, and a lot of times these companies are one-hit wonders. They've produced a single piece of software or hardware, and I've taken the time and effort to, you know, make sure that we've got their logos, find out where they were located, find out the story behind them where we can. I've interviewed some people running these companies, and so this is sort of, you know, our sort of special thing that we have is we take the time. Every single piece of software that we add to our website, I make sure that I do a company profile. It slows me down doing this because, like, obviously not all the software that we add is made by a bigwig like Microsoft. So, but I think that for software especially, you know, a lot of interesting stories to be told in these things. And I personally found it kind of fun to go back when, you know, when you remember playing a game from the 80s or using a piece of software and then going back and actually looking at the company that made it. It's interesting for two reasons. One, you can find out through our site what other pieces of software or items that they might have made, which was very difficult to perhaps do back in the day. And also, it's kind of neat to see where these companies are located. I know for me, you know, when I got into computing, you know, being 10, 11, 12 years old, didn't really have a full sense of the geography of the world, and so it's kind of cool sometimes to look back at these companies and find out either how close or how far away they were from you, and sort of to be able just to see, you know, where they were and maybe what else they did and the, you know, how long they survived. A lot of times you go back, you know, you look at a company like Cosme, for example, which made all kinds of games that I played in the 80s, Super Huey and Forbidden Forest and stuff like that. They're still around. I can't believe it. Like, they're still making software today. You can find some of their stuff in Walmart. I mean, it's amazing. So,
really?
Yeah. You know, it's, I'm shocked. but this is what we found out doing our research. So check out the companies. I think you'll find a lot of interesting things in there.
Okay. And it's, and you have an app?
Yes, we do have an app.
Your free app. On the iPhone app, at the App Store.
Yeah, for iPhone, we're working on an Android version as well. And it's kind of nice because it gives you a view of all the computers, but it also lets you look at our photographs that, you know, people doing different cool things with vintage computers every month. And also, it keeps you up to date when we're open and stuff like that. So it's kind of a handy app to have, and you can check it out and download it for free.
Coolio. So the only thing I have as a closing shot is I'm having a fire sale of my book. So I just want to move the I printed some more copies up for the VCF SE, and so I have some left, and so I have them on sale. They're only $18 shipped in the U.S. Basically, if you're outside the U.S., I'm just charging whatever the actual shipping is. You know, essentially, it cost me about $3 media mail in the U.S. to ship somebody a book. So whatever it is over to $3 is all you pay differently, you know, Canada, or it's like it'd only be like $2 extra for Canada, and then it actually went up quite a bit, the U.S. Postal Service.
Yes,
like, shipped
yes.
to somebody in
crazy
Europe or
much.
Whatever. I think it's like $18 now, the last time I shipped one. But well, I go to my website and go to the book and, you know, buy a copy of my book if you don't have one.
I think
one.
I got
to
get one of those, so we'll talk offline. You got to hook me up. I have
I'll give you a very special deal.
Okay, well, I have a book coming out, too, shortly.
Oh, okay, tell us about it.
I can't tell you about it yet. I have
legal
stuff that I have to get through. So, I'll tweet at you guys about it. It's about video games, about very specific video games, but very vintage. So,
make sure.
Yeah, it's something I've been working on for 2.5 years, finally coming out. So, I'd love to get a copy of your book. It looks very interesting. So we'll talk.
Okay, I was just looking at any closing remarks here. So Mike Whalen, our friend of the show, is going to Kansas Fest, and Michael Sternberg, who is Michael. When you get a chance, I was listening to Open Apple earlier today, the podcast, and they were talking about the Vintage Computer Festival Southwest, one in Arlington, Texas, and I think they're mistaken. They were talking about it coming up, and I went to the website, and I don't think they have one this year. Maybe you can tell us for next show what the deal with that. All right. Well, thanks again, Sid, for being on the show. I know Earl and Kieran will be sorry they missed you, and Kieran especially. He's supposed to be here.
Well, thanks for having me, and if you want me to have me back, just let me know. I'd be happy to join
in. Sometime we'll hit you up again.
Sounds good.
Emergency guest co-host.
Yeah, no problem.
Last minute, I tried to get another emergency guest co-host, but it's okay. But it was good just me and you on the show today.
Yeah.
But anyway, everybody, thanks a lot. Thanks for listening, for watching, and we'll talk to you all again soon.
All right, take care.
So, as usual, you're going to find show notes for today's show at our website at rcrpodcast.com. You can join us in the forums at vintage-computer.com/VC forum. So that's where we use that as our forum. We're at RCR Podcast on Twitter. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. And we don't get a lot of feedback, so please send some feedback. Rate us on iTunes. Always try to get people to send us audio. That'd be great. We'd love to include it in the show, an audio show anyway. So thanks for joining us, everyone. Until next time, we'll see you next time. Retro Compute.